Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Riley, Judge Sleater, Judge Frisch. The Honorable Denise D. Riley presiding. Calling the case A22-0110, State of Minnesota versus Matthew Warren Lupke.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I know that you both are familiar with our Zoom protocols. They are the same as if we were at MJC. You'll each have 15 minutes with 5 minutes for rebuttal. If at any time there are technical difficulties, would you raise your hand? We can stop the clock. That happened in the last hearing. Please state your name at the beginning of each argument. And with that, is appellant ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Scott Hersey, and I'm a special assistant Nicollet County attorney representing the appellant in this matter, the state of Minnesota. A district court abuses its discretion when its sentencing departure is based on an erroneous view of the law or is against logic and the facts in the record. And this is the jurisprudence from this court. And in this case, the state maintains that the district court abused its discretion both by an erroneous view of the law and its sentencing decision was against logic and the facts in the record, and its reasoning did not support the departure. The court's only stated reason in its departure report and on the record was that respondent lacked a substantial capacity for judgment at or around the time of the offense. And I believe that's a misstatement of the law based on the case I cited, State versus Janish, because it can't be around the time of the offense. Excuse me. It has to be at the time of the offense.
Mr. Hersey, one of the questions that came that I have relates to whether there's a factual basis for the district court's findings. And we don't have a trial transcript here. I know it was a court trial, right?
Correct.
But we don't have a transcript. So how are we to meaningfully determine whether there are indeed facts in the record that we just haven't been presented with on appeal that would support the district court's finding?
I would look to the transcript of the sentencing because there is the situation where the court laid out its reasons, and it gave several reasons, which I don't believe support the departure. And it specifically relied on the substantial capacity for judgment. It did not rely on anything else. And I think from the court's statements on the record, one can discern that the district court did not have a proper basis. And I think it had an erroneous view of the law in multiple respects.
Well, I'm not asking about an erroneous view of the law. I mean, that's a separate question. My question is whether the factual finding was clearly erroneous. We determine that by looking at the facts that were presented. And I presume that the trial related to the events that gave rise to the conviction, which would be at the time of the offense. So why isn't the absence of that record for us to review problem for your case?
Well, in the record, and I believe in the respondent's addendum, they did, and this was a court trial, by the way, they included the court trials, the district court's fairly extensive factual findings, and which recite the complaint, recite the information that was provided during the course of the trial. And I believe those factual findings, which of course, you wouldn't have in a jury trial, are sufficient for this court to look at those findings and see if there is, under Williams v. State, any other basis to support the court's departure, even if the court's stated reasons do not support it. So I would submit that the absence of the actual trial transcript in light of the district court's findings and its judgment of guilt would be sufficient in that regard for this court to review. And I would submit that the district court abused its discretion by its erroneous view of the law, as I said first, because the law does not provide that simply the person can have lack a substantial capacity for judgment around the time of the offense. And that's how the court phrased it on the record during the sentencing. There were no facts or findings demonstrating that the respondent lacked substantial capacity for judgment at the time the offense was committed. And in fact, I would submit that the Rule 20 report showed just the opposite. The psychologist documented doctor's reports in the Rule 20s that were shortly before and after the date of offense. And the date of offense was December 30th, 2018. And those appointments reported the respondent to be normal and that he exhibited no mental health symptoms. And those appointments were shortly before that December 30th offense date on September 24th of 2018. And then just slightly over 2 weeks after the offense was committed. And that second appointment was on January 18th of 2019. So I would submit that the Rule 20s show that he did not lack substantial capacity for judgment. I would note too that the court said on the record that one of the factors it considered in its departure was that it had determined that the respondent was incompetent to proceed to trial. And that was in July of 2019. But again, there has to be a nexus between the lack of substantial capacity for judgment and the time. And here we have two different times. We have the date of offense, December 30th of 2018, and an order of incompetency 7 months later. There really is no time nexus between the two of those. So I would submit that is an erroneous view of the law.
So I have another question. So the departure, you know, this is, when, you know, this is a durational departure because he was sentenced as a gross misdemeanor. The warrant of commitment notes that it's a dispositional departure, which seems like an error to me because he was not placed on probation. So what do we do with that?
That appears to be an error, and I would suggest to the court that counsel and I both agree that this is a durational departure, and this court's cases dealing with this issue would deem this to be a durational departure. Therefore, only offense-related factors are considered, not offender-related factors, with the exception of that substantial capacity for judgment. So
say we agree with you and this case should be remanded for resentencing. What direction are you seeking from us to the district court on resentencing? Does it have to be a guideline sentence? Can the district court reassess the record to determine whether a departure is appropriate for some other reasons? I mean, Ms. Lockwood is arguing in her brief that a durational departure would be appropriate because the offense is substantially less serious than a typical offense. And of course, there are no findings about that by the district court. So is the district court permitted to review that argument? What are you asking us to do?
I would submit not. I would respectfully disagree with Ms. Lockwood. And at the sentencing hearing, respondent's trial counsel made the argument that this was a less serious offense. The court made no findings on that, so presumably it did not rely on that factor. So I would submit that this should not be remanded for the court to have another hearing. In fact, this court has a statutory authority to impose the mandatory minimum sentence or the presumptive sentence, or it can remand to the district court. And if it does do that, I would ask the court to simply remand, as it has done in a number of decisions, directing the court to impose the mandatory minimum sentence. And that is what I would be asking the court to do in this particular case. The other erroneous—
Mr. Hershey, can I follow up a question Judge Frisch asked you? You made reference as an alternative to the full record, the court's findings from the trial, and as a basis to review whether there was clear error or clearly erroneous. And part of the reason I'm asking this is the judge is just orally using the verbatim of impairment. And obviously one could argue that it was imprecise, but he's talking orally while he's pronouncing the sentence. There's nothing in the findings. They're pretty much bare bones, as you know, simply just going to the elements of the crime. I assume the actual testimony and evidence would be what we would actually need to review to determine whether there was any evidence of impairment or when, if there was, and then that way we would have the full basis upon which to know there is an error of law and either reverse for that reason or affirm because it is supported.
Well, I would submit that the transcript is not necessary because from my perspective, the findings were, you may call those bare bones, but they were adequate findings, but there was nothing in those findings related to any type of impairment of the respondent at the time of this offense. And further, had there been any such impairment, presumably the district court, following this court and the Supreme Court's jurisprudence, would have referenced that in its findings at the sentencing hearing. And this is not something that just came up at the last minute. The court had given notice to both counsel that it was considering a departure. And so the court had given appropriate notice, appropriate consideration to a departure, and presumably should have followed this court's directives in its decisions as to what constitutes sufficient substantial lack of capacity. And the McLaughlin decision said that has to be extreme to the point that it deprives the defendant of the ability to control his behavior. And there is nothing in the record that I have seen so far that suggests that. If anything, it suggests that the respondent had simply been unwilling to control his behavior, not unable to. I would also submit that besides the failure to cover the extreme nature of the behavior, the district court's decision was also against logic and facts in the record, and that's another basis to find that the district court abused its discretion in this sentencing decision. It relied on the fact that the offense that prohibited him from possessing firearms was 10 years old, and I would submit that that's legally irrelevant. The prohibition was still in effect, and it was not diminished by time, so that would be an improper factor to rely on. It relied on the fact that the respondent had not been charged with any new drug offenses, but that ignores the fact that both Rule 20s and the PSI were replete with evidence that the respondent had chronically used drugs, abused his Adderall, and abused alcohol. In fact, the Rule 20s documented that he had 4 admissions to emergency rooms because of what the treating physicians described as drug-induced psychoses. He'd also been through chemical dependency treatment 4 times and later was taken to detox after the 4th treatment with a 0.28 BAC. So
Stop you right there and ask that the clock be stopped? I'm sorry, Judge Riley, we're being evacuated from the building right now. The sirens are going off and my clerk just sent me a note saying that we're supposed to leave the building.
Okay.
So let me see if I can figure out what's going on and if we can just press pause on this for a moment.
Thank you for letting me know.
Okay. I'm just going to check and see what's going on and see if I actually have to leave the building. Okay.
We will be in recess or pause.
Sorry. I'm so sorry.
Okay, we are back in session. We have given Mr. Hersey an additional minute because he lost a minute with whatever was going on at the MJC. So, Mr. Hersey, you may resume.
Thank you. I would submit that the Rule 20 reports of the psychologist did not find respondent's mental impairment extreme or cause him to be unable to control his behavior. Rather, the facts demonstrate that the respondent simply was unwilling to control his behavior. And I would ask the court to look at a couple of decisions that it has issued. One is State versus Law, where this court said that the district court's discretion is not a limitless grant of power and it would reverse a departure if it understated a defendant's culpability. But more importantly, I would ask this court to scrutinize State versus Johnish. And I think in that case, there are several parallels to this. And basically in that case, this court reversed the departure, the durational departure, because the impairment was not extreme for one reason. And their court had only said that the defendant's mental impairment limited his ability to make smarter, reasonable choices. And that is rather close to what was said here, where the district court said respondent's mental health negatively impacted his behavior. It did not find that it was extreme. Plus, in Johnish, the court stressed that there had to be a nexus between the defendant's mental impairment and the crime committed, and that was not shown in that particular case. And both of those factors are here. Further, I would ask the court to take a look at Janish, because there the Court of Appeals relied heavily on the pre-sentence investigation and the remarks made there. And they relied specifically on five different comments that the PSI had included. And all of those factors are present in the present case. And I would like to go back briefly to a question. I think the first question Judge Frisch asked me about a transcript. And I would suggest to the court that neither party here ordered a transcript. This was a court trial. It appears that both parties believe they could make their arguments supported on the record that we did have without a transcript.
It is, in fact, the case, Mr. Hersey, that the defendant did not raise the lack of capacity as an affirmative defense to the charges. Isn't that true?
That's true. That's true. Okay. It was not raised at any point during the trial.
So I presume that evidence regarding his lack of capacity was not introduced at trial because it would not have been pertinent to any of the issues in the trial?
Correct, but it was addressed extensively at the sentencing hearing. And I think that transcript and the arguments made there are quite thorough. In fact, I would say very thorough. But they did also make the argument, in addition to the substantial capacity issue, the respondent made the argument that there was another ground, and that was that the offense was less serious, an offense-related factor, than the typical possession of ammunition. And they relied on the factors that came out of the district court's findings of fact during the court trial. So they had an adequate basis to make their various arguments. And I'm not sure that it's necessarily required for the Court of Appeals to go scrutinizing a record beyond what has been presented by the parties that the parties think is appropriate for the court to decide the case when there has not been a transcript ordered and the respondent feels that the findings of fact from the district court trial were sufficient. But again, I would suggest that this was not a case that was less serious than the typical one. And I cited in my reply brief, State versus Goulet. And essentially the defense argument here is that, well, this was just constructive possession. He didn't have the gun in his hand when he was arrested by the officers. But I would submit that Goulet says that is not a basis. Possession is the same as constructive possession. That is not a basis for a downward departure. The fact that the respondent struggled with the officers, actively resisted them when he was arrested, suggests that this was not less serious. So I am asking the court to consider directing the mandatory minimum sentence. And if the court chooses not to do that, I would ask the court to find that the district court abused its discretion and remand to the district court and direct it to impose the mandatory minimum 60-month sentence. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Lockwood?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to start out by addressing appellant's argument that neither party ordered the transcript, and so both parties assumed that the record was complete for appeal. It is appellant's burden as the appealing party, the moving party, to order such transcripts. But I agree that there is sufficient evidence in the record for this court to review the district court's decision to depart here. An extensive findings of fact that were made by the district court in order to find, let me first start out by identifying myself and who I represent. My name is Catherine Lockwood, Assistant State Public Defender, here on behalf of Matthew Warren Lupke, the respondent in this case. Now I would like to address a couple of things from appellant's argument. The state did not raise an issue here with clearly erroneous factual findings by the district court. The state's issue here is that the district court's decision to depart is apparently not supported by the findings that we have here. That's just simply not true. The district court's decision to depart here is absolutely supported by the findings in the record. Not only is it supported by the court's finding that the offense was committed at a time when Mr. Lupke had diminished capacity, but it's also supported by other evidence and facts in the record. And respondent,
Let's talk about that. So having a diminished capacity is different than lacking the substantial capacity for judgment. And what I am struggling with, Ms. Lockwood, is where in the record that we have, which you are now saying is enough for us to engage in meaningful appellate review, where is the evidence that he lacked the substantial capacity for judgment, and that that was not drug-induced. Because when I look at the Rule 20 and I look at his history, there's a substantial amount of evidence that indicates that he experiences episodes that impair his judgment when he is engaged in some drug, in drug use. And in this case, there's the police investigator who indicates that he perhaps was at the time of the offense under the influence of an overdose of Adderall. So my question is where's the evidence that at the time of this offense that his mental state was such that he lacked capacity, substantial capacity for judgment for some reason other than his the use of drugs?
It was never proven. It was merely a speculation by the arresting officer that he may have been under the influence of Adderall at the time of the offense.
I agree with that, but there is that in the record, and I'm looking for something else in the record that would support your position.
Absolutely. The other exhibits admitted into the record, including the Rule 20 evaluation, and even the order finding him incompetent, and even the findings restoring his competency before he was convicted in this case. It contains evidence in the form of statements from his probation agent, from family members who testified at his competency hearing regarding the fact that in the time leading up to the offense that his capacity had been diminished, that his behavior as observed by his supervising agent who had supervised him for, I believe, about 10 years, his behavior leading up to this offense had gotten more concerning. He'd become more irritable. He'd become, his capacity seemed to be more diminished. And immediately following the offense, there's also statements from his defense attorney how he was had diminished capacity because he wasn't able to even follow simple conversations related to the defense in this case. And that was almost immediately after the incident. And none of these are alleged to have been caused by any voluntary taking of chemicals on the part of Mr. Lukey. This is simply allegations that his mental capacity was diminished at the time of the offense. And there's no indication that it was caused by Adderall usage or any other illicit drugs. It's simply the fact that his capacity was diminished. And I do want
to- what reason though? So that's my question. Like his capacity was diminished, but I'm looking for the why. I mean, we do have some evidence in the record that indicates that the why is drug use. And there are some episodes that correlate with his diminished capacity that relate to either illicit drug use or the overdose of prescribed medication. And so what, I mean, when I see his diagnoses, I'm struggling to connect those, his childhood diagnoses in particular, to the event at issue. Where's that evidence in the record?
Well, it's not necessary to connect his childhood diagnoses with the time of the offense to establish that he had diminished capacity at the time of the offense.
So then what is causing the diminished capacity?
It's also not necessary to know the specific cause of someone's diminished capacity. It's just necessary to establish that it's not solely because it's drug induced. And if you look to his history and the Rule 20 reports in the record here, it establishes that he did have diminished capacity at the time of the offense. And while he was in custody during proceedings here, he still retained diminished capacity. And it was established by his, I believe, his attorney at the time of sentencing that he had been free of all chemicals for at least 10 months by the time of sentencing. And again, it was not proven at the time of the offense that he was under the influence of chemicals. So it's not a factor that's been proven here that the diminished capacity was caused by the use of chemicals. That's what makes it a prohibited a factor to consider, is if we know that it was caused by the use of chemicals. That's not the case here. And even if the diminished capacity was an insufficient grounds for the departure here, you should still affirm, because this court has the authority, and as dictated by the Williams case, it shall review the record to determine if the stated reason by the district court was not sufficient, whether there are any other sufficient grounds in the record to support the departure.
Before you get there, Ms. Lockwood, I do want to just talk about a little bit more about what the district court's findings were and what the record contains. So there's a line of cases that the state cites that talks about how the diminished capacity must be of an extreme nature, and that that the diminished capacity has to rise to the level of some deprivation of the ability to control his actions. If you want to comment on that, the applicability of that law, and also how the facts here marry up with that law, that would be helpful.
Yes, Your Honor. The cases used by the state are very distinguishable from this case. First of all, I think it's important to point out that the Yannick case is not published, so it's not precedent here. And the Yannick opinion is distinguishable because there were three factors cited to support the departure. Both parties agreed that two factors didn't apply because they were offender-related factors. And so the only factor left was that the mental illness, the defendant's bipolar disorder caused him to have diminished mental capacity. And in that case, they said there wasn't a nexus between his having bipolar and his committing the very egregious offense in that case. And so because they couldn't, after reviewing the record, find other independent reasons to support the departure in that case, the sole stated reason of him having bipolar was not sufficient to support the diminished capacity at the time of the offense because it lacked a nexus. Now, turning to the State v. Law case, that case is the court deciding to reverse a departure that was based, an upward departure based on the severity of the offense. Now, in that case, it's an upward departure that was based on the severity of the, it reversed a downward departure based on the severity of the offense, but they indicated that the severity of the appellant's violent act in that case indicated that the departure was not appropriate. We don't have that here. That was the basis of overturning the decision in Law, was that it was the offense was so severe that they couldn't uphold the departure. And that's not here. We have offense.
And I appreciate I appreciate that summary, but what I'm trying to get at, and maybe my question is not as artfully phrased as I had hoped it would be, but when we look at cases like McLaughlin and Wilson that talk about a mental impairment is not enough on its own, it's what the mental impairment does to your ability to control your actions that is the thing that makes this case different than other cases, such that a departure would be appropriate. I'm struggling to find that evidence in the record that he was lacking in the ability to control himself. That's what I think is I'm struggling there. Can you help me out with the record?
Yes, I do find it important to again note that is not the sole reason that this departure can be affirmed here. That there are numerous other reasons. And in McLaughlin, it was affirming a district court's discretionary decision to impose an upward departure. So this court should do the same here, is affirm the district court's discretionary decision to impose a downward departure. Now, looking at the specific facts of this case and whether or not his mental impairment allowed him to receive that departure, if that was the only basis we had in the record, there are numerous places in the record that support that his mental impairment caused him to not be able to understand his actions. You can see from the criminal complaint, the reason that the police went to go look for him was for a completely unrelated incident, but he had locked himself in his grandmother's basement and they had to utilize family members in order to get him to come out. He had been apparently sleeping in that basement. No one knew about it. These are not normal behaviors from someone who's functioning at a normal level of capacity.
You're getting at what a comment I want to make to both you and Mr. Hersey. And that's that we keep talking about these offender-related behaviors, not offense-related behaviors. And this was a durational departure, not a dispositional departure, which... if it's a durational, we should be looking at offense related. Do you think the district court made a mistake in calling this a durational departure when the emphasis and the facts he cites all have to do with offender, with your client?
No, Your Honor, I do not. The court was very clear here that it to indicate that it exercised its discretion very carefully and knew what it was doing in imposing a durational departure. It tied the severity of the offense to his diminished mental capacity. And it also made findings regarding just generally the severity of his offense. Now, this is a felon in possession of a firearm conviction. And the only reason he received charges for this offense is after he was arrested and removed from the location. Upon searching the location, they then discovered a firearm and ammunition in the area that they assumed he had access to. He never brandished a firearm. He was never seen possessing a firearm. There was never any further DNA testing or anything done to show whether he ever actually possessed.
That goes to the sufficiency of the evidence, and that's not an issue on appeal. I mean, where is the evidence that he didn't know what he was doing? He didn't have any control over himself to be in the place with the firearm, to be in the basement. Where's that evidence?
That he didn't have any control over himself to be in the place where the firearm was located?
Right. I mean, like, that, isn't that what had to be found here? Like, his mental capacity was such that he didn't have any control over his actions to be in the same place with the firearm, to be in the grandmother's basement, to have the shotgun, whatever it is. Where's that evidence?
We don't know what came out during this court trial, but we have the findings of fact from the district court judge. So we have to rely on that. And we have to rely on the exhibits of the Rule 20 and the other extraneous evidence. And we know that.
Can we also rely on the fact that the lack of capacity was not asserted as an affirmative defense by your client at trial?
For whether it was used as a departure ground?
No, as a defense to the charges.
I guess I don't understand the question is okay. Whether we can rely on that as a factor because it wasn't raised as a defense.
Yes.
It doesn't matter whether or not it's raised as a defense. It can still be used as a factor in a durational departure because it's about whether or not the time of the offense connecting to the offense, the person while committing the offense had diminished capacity. But again, I think it's very important to look at the other reasons in the record here that very clearly support a durational departure. And in response to Judge Riley's question, this is clearly not a dispositional departure. The judge made it clear. This is not a situation where this person is particularly amenable to probation. I'm not putting him on probation. I'm not citing offender-related probation-specific factors. The offense-related factors, including the reason he was prohibited from possessing a firearm, being a drug offense that occurred when he was a juvenile over 10 years before, clearly demonstrate that this specific offense was less serious than the typical felon in possession of a firearm offense. So regardless of his capacity at the time of the offense, a review of the record in this case allows this court and calls for this court to affirm the district court's decision to impose a durational departure. So we would ask that this court affirm the district court's sentencing decision as it has the great discretion to make these decisions. And as I argued and placed in my brief, it's in the best position to evaluate the circumstances of this case and do so. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lockwood. Mr. Hersey, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Thank you, Judge. I would point out that respondent just indicated to the court that they believe that the evidence that is before the court without a trial transcript of the court trial is sufficient to decide the case. I would agree with that, and I would ask the court to accept that. Secondly, respondent uses the term diminished capacity, and that is not really what we're talking about here. What we're talking about is a specific definition of lacking substantial capacity for judgment as interpreted by McLaughlin. And I think counsel used the terms that his behavior was concerning and he was more irritable, and that was evidence that he lacks a substantial capacity for judgment. I would submit that that is not the extreme mental impairment preventing him from controlling his behavior that is required by McLaughlin. And granted, Jonish is not a published decision, but as the rule in the statute provide, this court can look to non-published and non-precedential decisions for its reasoning if it has persuasive value, and I would submit that Jonish actually does. As it relates to the respondent's acts, I would submit that his acts were not indicative of lacking substantial capacity for judgment, but logical for someone who has just committed an offense. He committed a domestic assault. He wanted to flee and avoid apprehension for that. He did not go back to his parents' home where he was living. He went to his grandmother's house where he had never been, never stayed, went into her basement by an outside door, the only entrance, barricaded himself in, locked himself in. And in being in doing that, he had to have taken his father's pickup truck, which the record shows he took without permission. And also he, without permission, took his father's 22 caliber rifle and ammunition. And
Mr. Hersey, one of the things that Ms. Lockwood is asking us to do is consider an alternate ground for a durational departure, that the offense was substantially less serious than a typical offense. And one of the arguments that she makes, which is found in the sentencing transcript, although not specifically in the form of findings, is that the defendant in this case was convicted of an offense while he was a juvenile, and that offense is over 10 years old. And the district court says that he didn't think that this was the kind of case that the mandatory minimum was supposed to apply to in the felon in possession statute, which I think the logical inference there is that this case is not typical. So do you want to address that?
Well, I would address that, Judge, by simply stating that the law is the law. The legislature made the determination that certain people should not be in possession of firearms or ammunition, and they put in the law a prohibition, and this individual is subject to the prohibition. And I would submit to
the court. I don't disagree with you that the legislature says the law is the law, but the legislature also, I mean, the sentencing guidelines do allow for departures from the law. So that's my question. Why isn't this case, given the circumstances that Ms. Lockwood has described, sufficiently atypical such that the law as it is written by the legislature should not apply?
Well, I'm afraid we're going down a slippery slope, Judge, if we say, well, you know, we'll apply the prohibition on firearms to one person, not another person, that if it's old enough or, you know, enough time has passed, we'll basically ignore it or not apply it or not apply the mandatory minimum that the legislature intended to apply. And I don't see that anywhere in the law. I don't see any case law supporting it. And I would urge this court not to follow that line of reasoning, because I think either he was prohibited or he wasn't. And I don't think the fact that the prohibition offense that may have been 5-10 years old has any less viability simply because of its age or because it was applied to a juvenile. Because again, the legislature did apply these laws equally to adults and juveniles. And finally, I would agree with counsel that I think the case law makes it clear that when a court takes a felony offense and imposes a gross misdemeanor disposition, that is a durational departure. And I would agree that we're not talking about amenability to probation or anything of that nature. We're simply dealing with either he lacked the substantial capacity for judgment or the other basis that they argued that this was significantly less serious than any other possession of a firearm. And I would submit that those facts are not there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case was well argued and well briefed, and we will have our decision out within the 90 days.